From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
Today, Wes Anderson talks about his new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. It's a melancholy comedy set mostly in the late 1930s in an elegant hotel in an imaginary Central European country on the verge of war. The film has Wes Anderson's trademark look, part real life, part handmade. Also,
I felt completely overwhelmed at work. I felt like I didn't spend enough time with my kids. I was just soaked in guilt all the time that I was a working mother and that I was somehow ruining their childhood.
Bridget Schulte talks about her book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. It draws on her personal experiences and the latest research on time management, stress, and work-life balance. And tech contributor Alexis Madrigal looks at the state of self-driving cars. First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with filmmaker Wes Anderson, whose films include Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Moonrise Kingdom. Anderson's new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, begins with an author looking back on his work, explaining how he came to write a book about the hotel.
A number of years ago, while suffering from a mild case of scribe's fever, a form of neurasthenia common among the intelligentsia of that time, I decided to spend the month of August in the spa town of Nebelsbad below the Alpine Sudetenwalds and had taken up rooms in the Grand Budapest, a picturesque, elaborate, and once widely celebrated establishment. I expect some of you will know it.
The Grand Budapest Hotel has a story within a story within a story. But most of the film is set in the late 1930s, in a fictional Central European country on the eve of war. Ralph Fiennes stars as the concierge of the elegant Grand Budapest Hotel. He makes sure everything is just so at the hotel. But as the movie progresses and the plot thickens, his world is violated by fascism, by the police who think he committed a murder, and by a greedy family looking to cut him out of a will. Along the way, Anderson pays tribute to war films, prison break movies, and screwball comedies. Here's a scene in which Ralph Fiennes, as Monsieur Gustave, the concierge, finds out that someone on his staff, without first consulting him, has hired a new lobby boy, the boy who helps guests in the lobby and runs errands. The lobby boy is played by Tony Revolori. They're walking through the lobby as they talk.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir. The new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher?
Yes, Monsieur Gustave.
Am I to understand you've surreptitiously hired this young man in the position of a lobby boy?
He's been engaged for a trial period, pending your approval, of course.
Perhaps, yes. Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
You're most welcome, Monsieur Gustave.
You're now going to be officially interviewed.
Should I go and light the candle first, sir?
What? No. Experience.
Hotel Kinski, kitchen boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, mop and broom boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience,
in the
zero.
Thank you again, Mr. Gustav.
Straighten that cap, Anatole. The pleasure's mine, Herr Schneider.
Mr. Asbusters.
These are not acceptable.
I fully agree.
Education.
I studied reading and spelling. I started my primary school. I almost finished.
Education, zero.
Now it's exploded.
Good morning, Cicero. Call the goddamn plumber.
This afternoon, Monsieur Gustave.
Will that fail, Frau Liebling?
What analysis?
Not now. Family?
Zero.
Six, Igor.
Wes Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this movie. Thank you so much for making it.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Your movie is about a lost world and a lost era, and it's a world and an era that you're too young to have experienced. I mean, a good deal of the story is set in the late 1930s, in the early stages of World War II. though it's not called that because everything in it is a kind of reimagining of the world. And I feel like, you know, I'm too young to have lived through World War II, but I feel like I've lived through it through the movies. I've seen so many World War II movies and so many Nazi movies over the years, and so many movies where people on trains during World War II are asked for their papers, and they don't have their papers, and there's that moment of tension which you play out in your movie, too. What is your connection to that era, and do you feel like you live through it through movies?
Well, yeah, I feel exactly the same thing. And in fact, I think that's why when you say it's reimagined, part of why I feel the impulse to reimagine it rather than just do it is because it's been done so many times before. This is such familiar historical territory. The reason I want to engage with it is because this series of events in Europe are somehow still right in the middle of our lives. And anyway, the impact is we just feel it in kind of a daily way somehow. For many years, I've been spending half of my time in Europe, and for the last few years, I just happen to have been reading a lot that relates to this kind of a setting and this period of history. Usually the movies that I'm making somehow are related to just the thing I'm particularly interested in whatever that moment is. And that's, one of the biggest inspirations for me was reading this writer, Stefan Zweig, who I'd never even heard of until about 5 or 6 years ago. And really, I just responded to, from the first page I read.
Which are the movies about World War II that made the biggest impression on you? And if you saw any when you were young that particularly scared you?
Well, when I was a kid, I remember we had World War II books. For whatever reason, boys are very interested in war. And there were Time Life books that were just, had every detail about the war, about the military machines. But, some of the inspirations for this movie are a bit odd. Like, I feel like as much as it might be a John Ford war movie, it's also, the sorrow and the pity and Shoah. Somehow those kind of...
movies about the Holocaust.
Yeah, they triggered something in me and made me want to kind of enter into this area.
You said that boys are interested in war, and there were all these like books for boys about the war, showing combat scenes in detail. Were you one of those boys interested in war?
Well, I think I was. I wasn't one of the experts. Some of these kids knew all the planes and tanks, and they built models of them and all that kind of stuff. I was in the school of thought where we had moved our wars into space. And that was really where you wanted to see the fighting. I think influenced by some important Hollywood filmmakers, we were more like we needed to be on foreign planets for the fighting.
So you weren't one of the boys who had the models of all the planes from World War II and the tanks, and you didn't know their names. But you must have loved models, though. Models of, planes or homes or anything, because, that's so much of what you do is create little miniature models of things.
Well, I do like models. I never was that good at them. My older brother, on the other hand, he always did models, and he's very, he has great dexterity, and he's just careful, and he made wonderful models, but I never could, I could never get those right. I was just in Chicago, and I went to see this thing I've seen many times. Have you ever heard of it? The Thorne Collection of Miniatures that's in the Chicago Art Institute?
I'm not familiar with it.
It's a wonderful... It's in the basement of the Chicago Art Institute. This woman commissioned these rooms, and they're all through history, and they're just... It's usually filled with kids, and they look through the glass, and they're just rooms, but they're so intricately detailed, and they are imaginary rooms, but they evoke different periods and different places, and you kind of go all around the world looking through windows into these tiny rooms. It's a really fascinating thing. I think there's something about miniatures. There's something kind of mesmerizing about them for whatever reason.
Wes Anderson is the director and co-writer of the new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. We'll hear more of his conversation with Terry Gross after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Are you ready to go for a ride in a self-driving car? Coming up, Fresh Air's tech contributor, Alexis Madrigal, looks at the current state of car automation, as well as what's just down the road. Also, we'll hear Terry's interview with Bridget Schulte, author of the new book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. That's ahead on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Wes Anderson, the director and co-writer of the new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. He also made the movies Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Moonrise Kingdom. The Grand Budapest Hotel is set mostly in the late 1930s, in a fictional European country on the verge of war. Ralph Fiennes stars as the concierge of the elegant hotel.
You've made the Ralph Fiennes character this really kind of like, you know, elegant character who like speaks very elegantly, and part of it is just kind of theatrical, and part of it is real for him. But you also in the movie put him in these kind of tough guy situations, like he's thrown into prison, and in prison. He delivers the food and kind of like spices it nicely for the prisoners and calls them darling as he delivers it. But he also is able to get these like beautiful pink cupcake-sized pastries, these wonderful delicacies. And so there's a scene in prison where he has one of these beautiful little pink pastries that he's dividing up for his cellmates. They're all like such tough guys. And he's dividing them up with what he calls the throat slitter.
Yeah,
I thought we could just hear that scene. And the bakery that it's from, which is mentioned in this clip, is called Mendel's. So here's Ralph Fiennes as Gustav. And a little later in the scene, we're going to hear Harvey Keitel, who plays one of his cellmates. And it's Harvey Keitel who starts talking about a possible prison break.
Good morning, Pinky.
Mendel's again.
Precisely. Who's got the throat slitter?
Out of this world.
Mendel's is the best. Well, back to work.
Mr. Gustav.
Yes?
Me and the boys talked it over. We think you're a real straight fellow.
Well, I've never been accused of that before, but I appreciate the sentiment.
You're one of us now.
What a lovely thing to say. Thank you, dear Pinky. Thank you, Gunter. Thank you, Wolf. Anything else?
Tell him, Ludwig.
Checkpoint 19 ain't no two-bit hoosegow. You got broad-gauge iron bars on every door, vent, and window. You got 72 guards on the floor and 60 more in the towers. You got a 325-foot drop into a moat full of crocodiles. But like the best of them, it's got a soft spot, which in this case happens to take the form of a storm-drained sewer system, dating from the time of the original rock fortification, way back in the Middle Ages. Now, nobody's saying it's a stroll down a tree-lined promenade with the fine lady in the white poodle, but it's got what you'd call vulnerability. And that's our bread and butter. Take a look.
And that was Harvey Keitel at the end of that scene. You had to visually create this world that you imagined, you know, because it's not, like we said, it's not a real country. It's not a real hotel. I'd say it looks real, but it doesn't quite look real. It looks like the Wes Anderson version of a real world that existed during World War II in Eastern Europe. How did you find the place to shoot? Because you shot on location someplace.
Yes, we did. The last movie I did is called Moonrise Kingdom. That was the first one after I did the animated one we talked about. And I had a very good experience making the movie. And part of what helped us was we found a key location or two, and we kept everything else very close physically to this. You know, geographically, we kept the movie quite contained. We shot it in Rhode Island, which, as long as you're staying within the borders, you know, the borders of the state, you've got a relatively contained operation. But I felt like I don't want to work in a movie studio. I've done it before. I don't like it. I like to be on location. I like to have input from the real world that is helping to shape what we're doing. But we adapt it. We're building sets and designing things, but we're designing them and building them out in the real world. And we did the same thing with this Grand Budapest movie. We found this department store in this town called Görlitz, which is in Saxony. That is Görlitz. Half of Görlitz is in Germany. The other half is in Poland. It's on the border. And it's about 20 minutes from Czech Republic. So in a way, it's really right where our story would be if there was such a place as the one in our story. This department store that we found, we made into our hotel, the big entrance hall of our hotel, and then we found everything else from the movie within a certain kind of radius of that department store, and we discovered all sorts of things and people as we traveled around figuring it all out, and we kind of made a pastiche of the greatest hits of kind of, Eastern Europe that found their way into our movie. And especially we met people in Budapest and in Prague and in Berlin and in Poland who we asked to come play roles, and their faces and voices are in the mix in the movie too.
In several of your movies, including this one, there's a combination of miniatures. Like, I assume that the outside of the hotel is a miniature as opposed to a full-scale building that you created. So there's this mix of miniatures and of, you know, real life and real scale things happening. And it creates this unique image, this unique movie that's very much like Wes Anderson, you know, because it's part handmade and part real. Can you talk about, like, intentionally going after that combination of part handmade and part real life?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, I thought we were going to find the perfect hotel, and that we'd just do it there. We didn't. You know, we looked for a very long time, and we found all kinds of great parts of hotels and ideas, but we didn't find the right one. And in fact, the more we looked, the more we wanted to use things from multiple places. So eventually, we had this, you know, me and the collaborators, I were Adam Stockhausen, our production designer, Jeremy Dawson, our producer, we decided we're going to do a miniature, and we set to work on designing it. The one of the advantages, I love miniatures. You know, it's just an old movie technique, an old-fashioned approach that I have always, there's a certain charm in miniatures to me. I just like them. But also, when you're doing a miniature, it means you can make the thing exactly the way you want. You have essentially no limitation. So we could put our hotel where we wanted it, we could make it look how we wanted it, and we could put things around it that we wanted. We sort of went a step further. Rather than making a miniature and putting it into a realistic setting, we were quite inspired by these paintings by Caspar David Friedrich, and their landscapes, their sort of views. And we used them in different ways, but we decided maybe we would make the whole sort of hillside, the whole spa town would be presented in a painting, in a sort of mural with the miniature in it. And we did it in the style of Caspar David Friedrich. So it became a miniature and a painting.
Did you stay? Well, actually, I read that the whole cast stayed in a hotel together. They all stayed in the same hotel during the shoot.
Yes, we had a small hotel in this town, Görlitz, that we managed to take over, a great little kind of quiet place, and we made it like our house. In fact, the guy who was the guy who owned the hotel was usually at the front desk, but he was also in our film at the front desk of the hotel in the movie. So we'd see him in the day behind the front desk in his purple uniform, and then at night he would somehow have already gotten back to the hotel where we lived, and he'd be there in his present-day outfit waiting for us behind that front desk.
So did everybody meet in costume for meals, or did they just meet as themselves, as actors?
They took off the costumes as quickly as they could.
Well, let me ask you, did you want to run into everybody from the movie when you woke up and went to breakfast, or did you want some time away from everybody?
I like to keep everybody together. I think, you know, in the mornings, everybody's kind of busy and doing their thing. You cross paths with everybody, but everybody's kind of hurrying to get themselves ready and get on the way. The makeup, for instance, and hair and stuff happened in the lobby of the hotel. They put on their costumes in the hotel, which is not the way it's normally done. Usually you go to the set and everything's there and people get put together there. We try to do it this other way. And
why? Why do you do it that way?
Well, I think it's just faster. You know, I think what happens is people go to a movie set and they're in their normal clothes and they show up and they get a coffee and they get something from the, from a craft services table that's filled with all kinds of little foods and things. And then they make their way over to the makeup and they check their text messages while they're getting made up, and then someone calls on a walkie-talkie and asks how much longer they'll be, and then they go and put on their costume. And it just doesn't have an urgency. And whereas I feel like if people wake up and it's right there and they do it and they get ready, and when there's a set time when they need to be in the car completely ready. You know, it's not about reporting to makeup at a certain time. It's about reporting to work at a certain time. That's just more, I just feel like it makes it happen quicker. But the other thing is I like to have, when we finish work, everybody goes back to the same place. And Rafe had said to me before, I told him, here's how we'd like to do it, and here's how we'd have it be. And Rafe said, well, what if I want some quiet time and I don't want to have dinner with everybody every day? And what if I have some other plan? I said, well, you do whatever you like. It's available to you. Well, Rafe was there for dinner literally every single night of the entire movie. I never saw him feeling like he wanted to go away. The actors, I feel they're drawn to each other, and it's usually very relaxing, and it's fun because the day's work is kind of high tension, and at the end of the day, people really do kind of just release themselves.
I want to play another scene from the film, and this is a scene when Ray finds, as Monsieur Gustave, who is the hotel concierge, one of the older dowagers who he is very close to has died, and so he and his assistant, the lobby boy from the hotel, go immediately onto a train to the home of the woman who died, where the will be read. And this is also just as the country is about to be invaded and war is breaking out. So they're on the train, and the Ray Fiennes character, Monsieur Gustave, is feeling very guilty because this wealthy dowager had been reluctant to leave. She had this premonition something bad would happen, and he said, just go, it'll be fine. So here he is on the train, and this is Tony Revolori as the lobby boy, his assistant.
I blame myself. She tried to tell me she had a premonition. I didn't listen. All of Lutz will be dressed in black, except her own ghastly, deceitful children, whom she loathed and couldn't bear to kiss hello. They'll be dancing like gypsies. There's really no point in doing anything in life, because it's all over in the blink of an eye. And the next thing you know, rigor mortis sets in. Oh, how the good die young. With any luck, she's left a few clue books for your old friend, but one never knows until the ink is dry on the death certificate. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84, Monsieur Gustave.
I've had older. When you're young, it's all fillet steak, but as the years go by, you have to move on to the cheaper cuts, which is fine with me, because I like those. More flavorful, so they say.
And the music in the background was by Alexandre Desplat. There's so many shots in this film and in some of your other films where there's, say, two characters standing side by side, looking straight ahead, kind of into the camera. And it gives the movie a very two-dimensional, like an intentionally two-dimensional look, whereas most movies are trying to give a three-dimensional look. But it also makes it seem like the character's looking at you, like they're staring at you while you're staring at them.
Yeah.
Why do you like doing that kind of shot? And I love the way it looks, and the expressions on the characters' faces are usually great too, and they're usually almost like still photographs. Like the actors are usually holding that expression for a few seconds.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think there's something about, you know, often you're kind of trying to get the eyes as close to the middle of the lens as you can, and really, I feel like there's just a electricity in people's eyes. The way the behavior is, you know, that doesn't come from me. It comes from them. But I have my own way of kind of blocking things and framing things that's sort of kind of built into me somehow. I compare it to being like handwriting. And I don't fully understand why my handwriting is like this. But in a way, there's some sort of tonal thing with the kind of stories I do. They tend to have some fable element. And I think my visuals sort of predilections are somehow related to trying to make that tone and make my own writing work with performers and something like that.
Wes Anderson is the director and co-writer of the new film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Driverless cars, once a futuristic sci-fi concept like smartphones and tablet computers before them, are closer than ever to becoming a reality. Tech companies and traditional car companies are developing automobiles that someday might give the blind and disabled greater mobility or drive the kids to soccer practice. Fresh Air's tech contributor, Alexis Madrigal, looks at the current state of car automation, as well as what's just down the road.
If you've heard about autonomous vehicles, cars that drive themselves, you probably associate them with Google, which is working on fully autonomous vehicles that will drive us to and fro while we're safely texting on our Android phones from the passenger seat. Not to be outdone by a tech company, the traditional car makers have major development programs too. The Mercedes S500 intelligent drive concept vehicle recently drove 100 kilometers between German cities. Nissan has promised some kind of autonomous vehicle by 2020, and GM's ENV concept car is a funny little electric pod that would detect pedestrians in a crosswalk and automatically slow the vehicle. Could also communicate with smart infrastructure and traffic optimization apps to, say, detect that a drawbridge is up and plot a route around it. Ford imagines packs of vehicles sensing their surroundings with stubby horn-like antennae and communicating about traffic conditions amongst themselves. There are a lot of steps, however, between Henry Ford's Model T and Google's autonomous Model X. Car makers need to figure out how to make vehicle-to-vehicle communication work, prove the safety and reliability of new technologies, and make them cheaper. Google's cars use tens of thousands of dollars worth of sensors. They also require a level of trust in the onboard computer that I at least find it difficult to muster. And let's not forget the problems of insuring a vehicle without a driver. Most of us, then, are going to encounter autonomous driving in little autopilot moments when we cede temporary control to a computer. In the near future, cars will take over for us in those special driving situations that teenagers practice for their driver's tests. Parallel parking? Let the car find the perfect angle of approach. squeezing into a tight space? Hop out and press a button on your smartphone. Already, in Nissan's new vehicles, the car detects when you've missteered into a turn and silently guides the wheels along a better trajectory. In the Volkswagen Passat, a technology detects the lane markings on the road with a front-mounted camera and gently countersteers if you begin to wander from your lane. Where Volkswagen is pushing the furthest, though, is in its Audi luxury car line. Some models already have an advanced cruise control that uses a long-range radar system to detect other cars and automatically adjust one's speed to maintain a safe following distance. And they're going further. I was recently invited to a demonstration of their newest generation of research projects. In the parking lot at Candlestick Park, south of San Francisco, I was riding in the back of a fancy Audi, following another Audi through two lines of orange cones. As the car in front of us stopped, the lanky German driving our car indicated that he was going to look away from the road and slam on the accelerator. And he did, and we did not crash. That's because two cameras mounted near the rear and side view mirrors had detected the movement of the driver's head, meaning his eyes, away from the front of the car, and using software developed at the University of California, San Diego, had told the car's onboard computer to switch into autopilot. As our driver pumped his knee up and down, wildly pressing on the accelerator, the car came to a perfectly smooth stop and waited for our man to take back control of the car. The larger point is that futuristic visions distract us from the ways in which cars are already making decisions for us. With each new generation of vehicles, they're taking on more and more tasks, proving themselves in particular situations. By the time Google's cars arrive in your driveway, you'll be acclimated to the idea of an artificial intelligence grabbing the wheel because you'll have handed over control tens of thousands of times. That's not to say that the transition will be smooth or without consequence, but that the many technical, legal, and personal hurdles that autonomous cars face will be worked out in much more limited settings, like the blacktop of the Candlestick parking lot or in the moment when you drift from a lane. This is how the future creeps into the present. While it might seem like your main computing device transformed from a Dell desktop into a smartphone overnight, there were thousands of little steps along the way that led to the moment when you realized the world has changed beyond recognition.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he edits the tech section of their website. Coming up, after a quick break, we'll hear Terry's interview with Bridget Schulte, author of the new book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. If your to-do list is so long that you are overwhelmed just looking at it, and if your list has you mentally racing back and forth between your responsibilities to your children and your job, what our next guest has to say may be helpful. Me? I don't even have time to make a to-do list. Our guest, Bridget Schulte, is the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. It's about the pressures on working mothers and fathers that lead to a constantly racing heart, consuming guilt, and the certainty that you've become inadequate at home and at work. Schulte interviewed researchers studying time management, stress management, family life, and gender roles. She examines workplace and government policies that affect working parents in the U.S. and compares them to those in other countries. And she describes her own anxieties as the mother of two with a high-stress job as a reporter at the Washington Post. She's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. More stress. Her husband has a high-stress job, too. He's Tom Bowman, who covers the Pentagon for NPR. Schulte spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Bridget Schulte, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about the book, we have to talk about the cover, because this is like my favorite cover in a really long time. So the title, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, and your name is kind of outlined in one of those, you know, highlighted in one of those yellow highlighters as if it's like stuff you have to remember on your list.
Right, right.
And then written in what looks like pencil is all kinds of like things on your to-do list, like chicken cutlets, granola bars, almond butter, taxes, exclamation point, get new flash drive, use it, reschedule a flight to Austin, melatonin, sunscreen, 3% raises this year, memo to Kevin and Marty, and that's crossed out. I guess you did that.
I did.
Fill out CAM forms, find geometry tutor. That's just a small part of it. And it's all kind of like scribbled in pencil. Did you do that to-do list part on the cover of the book?
Well, you know, it's really funny. When we were designing the cover, my publisher and editor, Sarah Crichton, who's just wonderful, she sent me a note and said, you know, we're thinking of doing something with the to-do list, and what should we put on the cover? And I just sent her a note back. I was like, do you want my to-do list from this week? And she said, sure. So I sent her my to-do list, and then they embellished with some others. You know, I did try to weigh in later when she said, you know, there's something at the top that said tonic and limes. I'm like, you know, that makes me feel like gin and tonics, and that was not on my list. But, you know, the memo to Kevin and Marty, I'm a reporter at the Washington Post. That was a memo I wrote to Marty Baron and Kevin Merida, the two top editors there. And the dentist with the exclamation point is definitely something I had to get my kids to. And yes, find the geometry tutor and fill out the camp forms. Yes, that's,
and,
you
and
know.
Then there's Max to vet, try yeah, diet cat food, you know, question mark.
Well, we do have a very big, fat, fluffy cat named Max. And I did have to get him to the vet, although we still haven't tried the diet cat food.
You use the expression, well, you found out about the expression contaminated time. What does that mean?
Yeah, no, I found out about it. Boy, I wish I were smart enough to have come up with that, because it just describes so perfectly, I think, certainly what I was feeling, and I think is a pretty pervasive feeling out there. And what contaminated time is, you know, even though men are doing more at home and with the kids, women are still seen as the default parent or primarily responsible for the home sphere, because that's the way that it's always been. And so what happens is now you're juggling work demands on top of all of the stuff that you've always had to do at home. We've ratcheted up the standards for what you need to do as a parent. And what that does then is it completely pollutes your time, so that you may be in a moment that could look like leisure from the outside, but on the inside, you are just crashing around thinking of like, oh man, what have I got for dinner? And I forgot the carpool that, you know, to drive tomorrow. And did I ever send this note? And I better get this memo to somebody at work. And so you're never really fully present in the moment. You know, and as new agey as that sounds, there's been really great work by psychologists who say that's really peak human experience when you're able to lose yourself in the moment.
But what you're leading to, too, is I think that being overwhelmed by too many responsibilities of being a parent and working leads to this kind of panic, this constant state of panic.
Well, it doesn't have to, you know, I think that's what I found, is that so much of where that panic originates is because our workplaces haven't changed. Our workplaces still expect and demand us to work as if we had no families. our laws are still, we're still governed by the Fair Labor Standards Act that was written in 1938. You know, we have the Family Medical Leave Act, which is really the only piece of, if you want to call it, family-friendly legislation that we have. And when you compare the United States to what other countries are doing around the world, we are really at the bottom of the barrel. We have not made it easier for people to work and have families.
Compare us to Denmark.
Oh, well, let's see. Where do I start? Let's start with work. At work, people in Denmark, they have, by law, short hours, short, very intense, bounded hours. You work a certain amount of time, and that's it, and you go home. But what I also saw when I was over
there. Did they throw you out or something when you're tired?
No, but this is interesting. They feel there, if you work overtime, you're simply inefficient. That you're not getting your work done when you need to be getting your work done. They take short, a half-hour lunches, and it's usually their workplaces have this fabulous smorgasbord. You know, I went to a couple workplaces and ate with them. But it's healthy, it's wonderful, and then they want you to get right back to work, and so that when the workday's over, you leave. And then when it comes to the play part, it's also a society that values leisure time and values balance. I spoke with an American over there who she kept getting dinged on her annual performance evaluations because she worked too long and they felt that her work-life balance wasn't enough of a priority for her. They wanted her to have a fuller life outside of work.
Well, the leave policies for new parents, I thought that was really interesting because you get a year's worth of paid parental leave to be divided between the mother and the father or the two parents as they see fit.
Absolutely. This is what's so interesting when you look at what different countries are doing. Countries in Europe, particularly the Nordic countries, and I can go back to that because there's a lot of fears in the United States that they're socialist and we don't want to do what they're doing. And I'm not advocating that, but I think that we can learn a lot from what they're doing. And the most important thing is that they're dividing that paid parental leave between mothers and fathers, countries like Denmark, Sweden, and Iceland in particular, because what they're finding is that when you give fathers solo care time with their children early on, it substantially changes the division of labor in the relationship later on. So if you want to have an egalitarian marriage, if you want an equal partner, the best way to do it is start out from the very first with equal responsibilities. And what they're finding, there's been fascinating studies that 3 and 5 years later, those marriages have a much fairer division of labor between work and home, between the men and the women.
Let's talk a little bit about your life. You write that when you had your first child, you made a bargain with yourself that you would be, you know, basically the primary parent, but you wanted your husband to say, thank you. But you ended up getting very resentful about the arrangement. Can you talk a little bit about that bargain that you made with yourself and why it didn't work for you?
Well, actually, that bargain came after many, many years. When my husband and I got married, I was very adamant that I wanted a partner. I love and respect my parents, but I did not want the traditional marriage that they had. What I wanted from my life was very different. And so I made sure that my husband, Tom, was also on the same page, that we wanted to be these equal partners. And we really were. We had a really fair division of labor. Everything felt great. And then we had our first child. And I think without realizing it, I felt like I should be this kind of super mother. And I felt like I needed to do everything that my mother did while at the same time trying to work like my father did, you know, without realizing how impossible that was. But in me sort of taking that primary responsibility, I think, to be fair, both because I wanted to, but also because I felt like I had to, that kept Tom kind of in a secondary role. And this is what I didn't realize at the time. And if nothing else, I hope that this book will help people not make the same mistakes that I did. That time when you bring the first child home is a crucial time for setting the trajectory of your relationship from then on out, particularly in the division of labor. And so what happened over time, I just assumed I should do everything. I took the kids to the doctor. I stayed home when they were sick. I flexed my schedule. I went part-time. I expected Tom to do none of those things. I kind of gave him the out to still be the breadwinner father. But then he'd come home and, you know, I would be so furious that I was the one paying the bills and doing the dishes and weeding the garden. And why was I doing all of this?
And you're right. And he got to be the fun parent.
And he did. He was a great dad, but he did all the fun stuff. And then I was the nagger, and have you done this, and why didn't you clean up your room? And you know, it sort of turned me into this role that I didn't like seeing myself in. So I just made this bargain. I got so angry. I was just so angry and defensive. And it really took me a long time to see how much I had been a part of creating that, because I thought I had to be this ideal mother.
What else do you feel like you did to create it?
Well, because I didn't let Tom have time alone with the kids. I felt like, you know, when you think about it, I had the maternity leave. Tom at the time worked for a company that had a policy on the books that said that men could take parental leave, but everybody knew that if a man did it, it was a kiss of death. It was just not done. I think that's pretty common out there, that you have these wonderful sounding policies, but in reality, you know you can't take them. So that he was in that kind of position at that time. So I took the longer maternity leave. And I think we both thought that, well, you know, women are just wired to be the mothers and the caretakers. Isn't that just sort of biologically determined? Isn't that the way that it should be? And I think we both assumed that was true. And that was what was interesting, is finding out, it's like, wow, men also have biological changes. Ooh, men are also wired for nurture. I mean, that was a huge revelation to me in the book. And that what the biggest difference is that women are given the time to develop the confidence and the competence to know what an infant needs and how to take care of an infant. And then we assume that that's natural, but we've just had the time to figure it out, what this fuss means, what that cry means. And then the baby gets accustomed to you, so that the dad comes home at the end of a long work day, you're fried, you know, you haven't had your shower yet. All you've done is clip the baby's fingernails, and you don't know what the heck you've done with the rest of your day. And, you know, you hand the baby over and you just need to have a little time to yourself. The baby starts to fuss. The guy freaks out and hands the baby back to you, and you get all angry. And that's why I found the research about taking solo parental leave making a huge difference later on. Because you've got to give guys the time to develop that same competence and confidence.
You said that scientists are showing that men undergo biological changes when there's a new baby. What are those changes?
This is what's fascinating. Their testosterone levels drop, which they may not be very happy about, you know, just because we so value the macho aspect of testosterone. But it drops when you are not only have a child, but spend time around it, a child. They also have hormones. They have prolactin, which is, you know, the hormone that stimulates breast milk. Their levels also increase. You know, certainly they don't spike like women's do, but they have biological changes. There was a syndrome that men who gained weight, you know, when their wives were pregnant, that was always seen as psychosomatic, but it's really not necessarily. And there's really good evidence in the animal world that males are also wired for nurture. And I think what's fascinating is humans are social creatures. We survived because we socially cooperated with one another. We had what was called cooperative breeding. We all helped one another out way back in the Pleistocene era. So much so that neuroscientists have done fascinating work that even strangers, when they see babies, they have parts of their brain that light up that are also associated with nurturing and caretaking. So even strangers are wired for nurture.
Once you figured out that you and your husband had kind of taken on almost traditional gender roles in child rearing and housework responsibilities, how did you redivide things?
Well, it was hard. And, you know, it's still a work in progress. You know, believe me, it's kind of nice when you don't have to do the drudgery of housework, right? You know, why would you want to sort of start doing that if somebody else is doing it for you? I remember I used to always sort of lament, I need a wife. You know, I want somebody else to do all that drudge work. So once we kind of came up with common standards and we started to divide things, then we had to work to keep each other accountable. And then I had to really work not to redo Tom's job or to come in and swoop in and rescue the kids. I had to kind of pull back myself. So what I started doing, say, for instance, we came up with an agreement. Okay, last out of bed makes the bed. I mean, as stupid as that sounds, all of these little things, if you're expected to be doing it all the time, they can really build up and they eat your time, they fragment it, and they also create resentment. So on the days when Tom was supposed to make the bed, if he left the pillows on the floor, which he did for a while, I wouldn't pick the pillows up. I would take a photo on my iPhone and text it to him to sort of keep him accountable. But then I had to not pick up the pillows. Same thing we came up with an agreement. I would empty out the dishwasher in the morning. He would load it. And so when I was writing the book, I was working in my home office. And for a long time, I would just like, oh, well, I'm here. I'll just go ahead and do it. And I had to physically stop myself. It's like, this was the agreement that we made. I am working too. My work is also valuable. I want to make sure that I get my work done so that I can have family time. So this, I'm not going to take this on. And obviously, there's some fluidity here because there are times when he's in a crunch. Of course, I'm going to do it. There are times when I'm in a crunch. He's going to do it. You know, so, you know, you have to be flexible and adaptable as well. But we tried to figure out how to keep each other accountable.
Let's talk about other changes you've made in your life as a result of all the research that you learned about in the course of writing your book. So how does your to-do list compare now with what your to-do list used to look like?
That's probably the biggest change. I used to have a to-do list that just weighed on me, like this huge weight that I felt like I had to get to the end of it before I could do anything fun. It was almost like I used to call it this if-then mentality. If I finish all these tasks, then I can get to the important stuff. And I think it was a huge revelation for me. I did want to learn about time management, which I think is a joke. I don't think you can manage time. You know, all of the strategies out there to help us cram more stuff into our calendar is really not the answer. It's figuring out what's important to you and then making time to do what's most important first. But I was at a time triage seminar to try to help you figure out how you spent your time and why you were feeling so overwhelmed. And it was this exercise where they gave us this blank calendar. And first they said, fill out what you did in the last week. And I was there with a group of people and we all just busily scribbled everything in that we could do. And we were writing on the sides and, you know, all sorts of stuff was coming out. And then she stopped us and she said, now, if you had as much time in your life as you wanted, what would you do? And we all threw things out like read, spend more time with my partner, you know, go for a walk, enjoy the sunset, all this kind of stuff. And she said, where is the time for that in your calendar? And none of us had any of that in there. It was just filled with all this to-do garbage. And so that was a huge revelation, that to-do list will never go away. If you have this if-then mentality, you will never get to then. And so I have trashed the to-do list. To help my brain, I do get it all out. I write it all down because then it kind of gives me kind of mental peace that I don't have to try to keep remembering it. But right now I try to do one thing a day. And if I can do it, that's great. And if I write stuff down, I do it and also give myself permission not to do it.
Bridget Schulte is the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.